Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming along this evening. When I titled my talk, Evolution, the Hoax That's Destroying Christendom, I suppose I took on a big job. In less than an hour, I have to demonstrate, firstly, that evolution worldview is a hoax. I was going to call it a fraud, but I think hoax is a less unkind word. Then I have to establish that a scientific viewpoint could be destroying Christendom. And not only could be, but is. And that will mean a busy hour. But keep your minds open and bear with me while I start with a flight of imagination. Let's suppose that the ghost of Charles Darwin could leave his tomb in the Abbey and step forth into the modern world. He'd find some changes have been made. In the world Charles Darwin knew, Christendom was the predominant culture. Christendom dominated the world. Today that's not so. Darwin's ghost would notice something, something that Bishop Fulton Sheen noticed, and perhaps you've noticed it too. Christendom is dead. Not Christianity. Christianity can never die. But the culture that it kindled, the social and political culture that Christianity inspired, that is Christendom, and Christendom is dead. We are no longer living in a Christian culture. Christendom is dead, and it was killed by the theory of evolution. Darwin's ghost would notice that the Christian God has no real status in this new world, and has no status at all in our temples of science and our halls of learning. The Creator God has been deposed, and a new God enthroned, namely, the mystic force of evolution, and with it, the concept of eternal matter. Eternal matter ever evolving on and on from nothingness to man and even beyond. Darwin's ghost would be wild-eyed when he realized that this is his making. God has been displaced by Darwinism, or rather by what Darwinism has grown into. Yet as he looked around, he might marvel at a strange prodigy, that of ministers and clergy of the Christian God allying themselves with anti-Christian zealots to spread Darwinism. Churchmen and infidels allied in the common cause of anti-God. What a turnabout! You can hear Darwin's ghost say it, what a turnabout! When I expired a century ago, churchmen anathematized me and my theory. Now I find them admiring the very thing that I let loose. Churchmen paying tribute to the monster that devours their God. Yes, the changes have been vast. Adam, the Creator's masterpiece, was the first to go, ousted by the ape-men. These hairy ape-men, which I assure you never existed except in wild imagination, these ape-men played havoc with the pivotal doctrines of Christianity, namely, original sin and redemption. When the ape-men entered, Adam went out. And with him, original sin and redemption went out. From the very start, Darwinism was an infidel creed. Then it was expanded on and built on by successive unbelievers. They enlarged it into the general theory of evolution, which is quite atheistic, because it insists that every object, everything in the universe, developed or evolved from some previous stage. But never at any stage was there any creation. Never was there anything supernatural in the process. The general theory of evolution teaches that the universe started when primitive gases exploded in the Big Bang, and as they rushed outwards, they formed themselves into galaxies and stars and planets. Eventually, by impossible good luck, some lifeless matter became alive. Of itself, without any help, it became alive. Then it went on improving itself into jellyfish and frogs and animals and primates and man. And note this well, it did all this by purely natural processes. Hydrogen gas evolved into men, with no help from the supernatural. No God had a hand in it. So if you want a definition of hydrogen gas, you can now say, hydrogen is a colourless, odourless gas which, if left to itself, turns into men. In this general theory, nothing exists but matter. eternal matter in an eternally expanding universe, or maybe an oscillating universe. Oscillating would make the eternal part easier, and they're working on that. And man. Man himself is a mere accident of evolving matter. An incredibly marvelous assemblage of matter, but nothing more than that. And man must make his personal heaven here on earth before he crumbles back into the earth matter from which he was briefly assembled. This new creed, unheard in Christendom since Christendom began, this new creed has changed the Christian man into the modern secular man, whose distinguishing mark is that he never has a thought for God, and has no purpose but materialism, the secular man. In the modern classroom, he's learned the new morality, values clarification, which holds no absolutes of right and no absolutes of wrong. You make your own rules according to the situation. Now, since nothing exists but matter, the material universe is all, is everything. Therefore, the universe must have some immanent force, like the force in Star Wars. A force which does the things which God was supposed to do. This calls for a semi-godlike cosmic force evolving the universe upwards. In this upward sweep of evolution, the sum of it all is man. Man, the peak of evolution, to whom nothing may dictate. So God is the universe. God is man. Man is God. We're getting into pantheism. The universe is God. And that is what happens when you scrap the Christian revelation. Man reverts to pantheism. Because pantheism is the natural religion of humankind when deprived of Christian revelation. Since Darwin, and because of Darwin, the Christian vision has gone. The evolution vision has come. Now, neo-pagan science is wrapped in what they are calling the evolution vision, which regards the universe as a living entity. So our new science can talk like this, quote, life appears no longer as a phenomenon unfolding in the universe, instead the universe becomes increasingly alive, unquote. And this gem, quote, evolution can be viewed as the expression of an inherent playfulness of an always intelligent universe, unquote. Well, there's no trace of Christianity or God in all this. This is pantheism. God is everything. And our new educators are purveyors of this pantheism, with some help from modernist theologians. This is what Darwin's dark light has done. It has led men away from Christian revelation, all the way to the pantheism of the pagans. As Darwin's ghost surveys the modern world, he might remember a familiar voice reprimanding him. The voice of Darwin's own teacher, Sedgwick of Cambridge. Sedgwick, who warned Charles Darwin from the very beginning that if his evolution theory caught on, humanity would suffer a damage that might brutalize it and sink it to its lowest degradation. Darwin's ghost must admit that Sedgwick was right. His prophecy is being fulfilled in this post-Christian world. A fearsome atheism called Marxism is advancing, and Christendom is shrinking physically before it, shrinking physically and dying spiritually, poisoned by its own new philosophy of mechanistic evolution. Before the God of science, religion has compromised. The Bible is demythologized, doctrines are diluted, and the Ten Commandments are dismissed along with the lawgiver. Apostasy grows, families disintegrate, even music is nearly obsolete. Music, meaning the singable and the whistleable, that has been silenced by rock beat. Rock beat, the parody of music foisted on the young by the same schemers who scheme to destroy religion and take over the world. Rock with its own subculture of drugs, sex, occultism, and worship of superstars. All this would come as a bit of a shock to the ghost of Darwin, and he'd be shocked to see the growing tempest of terror and violence which has changed the face of Christendom into a brutal face. You see, when God is dead, human life is cheap. When God's authority disappears, all moral authority starts to disappear. Then political authority depends on muscle, and ultimately it depends on the gun. Inevitably has emerged the end product of what Darwin started, a degenerating Christendom which glorifies the very pseudoscience that's destroying it. Darwin's ghost might argue that many other powerful forces have been at work, and that's true. But those other forces needed the right tool. The tool wherewith to extract God from men's minds. And Darwinism was the right tool. Darwin was needed. For a long time before Darwin, there'd been other propounders of evolution, but they never made much impact. Then along came Darwin, and he supplied the magic ingredient, survival of the fittest, or natural selection. Natural selection acting on biological changes. Natural selection was the magic that launched evolution on its conquest of the world's mind. Darwin supplied the tool, and the anti-God forces grabbed it. Yet, might Darwin argue that facts are facts, and religion must defer to scientific fact, that his interpretation has been ratified by rigorous science. Well, the answer to that must be the cruelest blow of all to ambitious Charles Darwin. The science that lauded him for over a century has suddenly dumped him. History was made in October 1980 when 160 of the world's leaders in evolution assembled at a convention in Chicago. From that convention of top evolutionists came the world-shaking admission that the fossil record now points overwhelmingly away from classical Darwinism, that there is no fossil evidence of anything evolving into anything else. The convention, in effect, pronounced the death of Darwinism, and then there was little further use for natural selection, Darwin's magic ingredient. What a blow for the ambitious Charles Darwin, who aspired to rival Newton. A blow that meant the end of a great ambition. So, it's back to the tomb for this unhappy ghost. But if the word spreads that Darwin got it all wrong, will even the tomb be safe? Can an undone Darwin remain entombed in a place of honour beside Newton? There'll be red faces in Westminster Abbey. And another thought, there'll be red faces in Australia's Northern Territory. I wonder, will those citizens change the name of their capital city when this gets known? Being Darwin's ghost is not going to be much fun anymore. In 1859, Darwin proposed his theory of evolution by gradual steps. To back it up, he needed fossils of intermediate creatures, intermediates between the perfected species. He hoped that the fossils would turn up. Well, the digging went on for a century, but no intermediate fossils showed up. Eventually, the experts began to realize that there are no intermediates. Still, the charade went on until 1980, when the truth could be avoided no longer. And then the Chicago Convention belatedly admitted the obvious, that the fossil record gave no evidence of evolution, steps, and stages. Did the experts then apologize to the world? Did they show remorse for having taught the error of Darwinism to countless students? Did they recommend a return to creationism? No, sir, they did not. They've been forced to admit that the fossil evidence disproves Darwinian evolution, but they won't abandon evolution itself. If the evidence isn't there, to hell with the evidence. Let it be evolution without evidence. Let it be evolution by huge jumps that would leave no evidence. So now the new proposal is that there were long periods of no change, then suddenly a brief spurt with species changing so rapidly that no fossil evidence of the changes can be found. That's the new theory. Millions of years of equilibrium, no change, punctuated by short periods of fast change. So it's called punctuated equilibria. Evolution by punctuated equilibria. And it sounds impressive, but it violates all relevant laws of science as well as common sense. The good news is that they dumped Darwinism. The bad news is that they turned to an even worse theory. They may dignify it with the title punctuated equilibria, but it's only a rehash of the bizarre theory of the hopeful monster, which they had been deriding, had been ridiculing for 40 years. 40 years previously, a Dr. Richard Goldsmith, after long research, became convinced that Darwinian evolution, that is by gradual change, is impossible. To what alternative could he turn? Creation? Not Goldsmith. He was a dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist. So he satisfied himself by proposing that evolution must have happened by sudden whopping big jumps. He proposed that, from time to time, a monster would have been born, a monster very different from its parents, but not a hopeless monster. Not one which would die as hopeless monsters die. Instead, this was a hopeful monster, and it survived, and it gave rise to a new species, different from the parent stock. Thus, by a series of many hopeful monsters, all the varieties of species and kinds would evolve by jumps. Goldsmith concurred with the suggestion that this could mean that a reptile laid an egg and a bird hatched out. Goldsmith's hopeful monster theory was ridiculed by both sides. Not only did the creationists laugh, the evolutionists laughed too. And the Darwinians continued to laugh at the hopeful monster for 40 years. Then in October 1980, they about-faced. They adopted the hopeful monster theory and called it punctuated equilibria. Evolution is in real trouble on every front. But this fact is not getting through to the public because the mass media and the education system won't allow it to get through. Evolution is in trouble because scientists themselves have mounted a counterattack, especially in the last 20-25 years, under the leadership of the Creation Research Society of America. Further back in the past, when evolution was enjoying its heyday, many giants of science rejected it, but as individuals, like the eminent Louis Bonnouret of France. He put it this way, quote, "Evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless." Unquote. Louis Bonnouret. Damning words from a great scientist, but spoken as an individual. Other great scientists publicly renounced evolution, but as individuals. In England, since the 1930s, a scientific body, the Evolution Protest Movement, now renamed the Creation Science Movement, produced a steady output of scientific literature against evolution, but it made little impact against the power of the media. Evolution was a tidal wave, and then something happened. Evolution was still at high water mark in 1963, when a small event happened which was to turn the tide. That event was a meeting of 10 scientists in America. A dedicated 10 who saw that organization was needed. Organization to fight evolution on scientific grounds. In 1963, those 10 scientists founded the Creation Research Society of America. Its growth has been dramatic. It now comprises over 600 scientists, probably more, and many of them have advanced degrees. This society and its associate, the Institute for Creation Research, plus another body, the Bible Science Association, have produced a massive scientific literature against evolution. Furthermore, they have forced public debate. They have outflanked the biased mass media and have staged scores of open debates against prominent evolutionists before large audiences, sometimes of 1,000, even of 2,000. And frequently on university campuses. Evolution champions found the going unexpectedly tough against these skilled debaters, and the mortal weaknesses of evolution were exposed publicly. Evolutionists were forced onto the defensive for the first time. The evolutionists were outgunned. They were unable to get far on the merits of their case, so they adopted the tactics of denigrating creation scientists through the mass media. The obedient mass media jumped in to help the evolutionist cause. In the press and in the schools, evolution was pushed harder. Television rallied to the cause with a series of expensive shows promoting evolution and presented in prime viewing time. In spite of all these odds, creation scientists hammered away, presenting the evidence. And the evidence was deadly for Darwinism, so deadly that, as we have seen, Darwinism was dumped officially by the Chicago Convention in 1980. And that happened so unexpectedly that television was caught napping, and those TV spectaculars continued to uphold Darwinism after Darwinism was discredited. Eventually, in July 1982, the ABC televised Did Darwin Get It Wrong?, which was a fairer presentation. It confirmed that Darwinism is obsolete, but then it went on to uphold the new official stance, which is that, despite the evidence, evolution must be taken as fact and must never be doubted. So, if the Darwinian brand of evolution is repudiated, then a substitute evolution must take its place. So the ABC show turned sympathetically to the new theory of punctuated equilibria, or evolution by big jumps. Finally, it did admit that, at this stage, there is no real evidence to support evolution by big jumps. By now, you must be asking the questions. 1. Why do scientists, who are good scientists, debase true science in order to keep this evolution theory afloat? And 2. Why do the moguls of the mass media and the overlords of education tamper with truth in order to propagate evolution and censor creation? The answer to both questions lies in the attitude of modern formal science, an attitude revealed by Professor Watson in 1929 in an address to the British Association, an attitude you'll find in utterances by other scientists since then, an attitude which can be summarized more or less like this. The theory of evolution is universally accepted, not because it can be proved true, but because the only alternative is special creation, and that is clearly not credible. In effect, it means science cannot accept special creation, therefore the only explanation is evolution. So we'll hold to evolution no matter how much the evidence goes against evolution. It shows how science has closed its mind since the days of the fathers of science, men like Newton, Maxwell, Faraday, Kelvin, Kepler, etc., etc., intellectual giants who dwarf the anti-God scientists of today, great minds of science who acknowledged the Creator and who saw themselves as humble men who were thinking God's thoughts after Him. When we understand how the attitude of science has changed and has become hostile to creation, then we understand why modern scientists and the mass media and the schools are carried along by this modern attitude, so that they go to extremes to sustain evolution and put down creation. There are only two alternatives. It has to be one or the other, either evolution or creation. There is no third choice. Before Darwin, it was common for science to bring God into the picture. Darwinism has changed all that. The establishment attitude has become inflexibly hostile to creation and creator. So evolution is accepted because creation cannot be tolerated. Do you now see that evolution is the creed of the anti-Christian and the refuge of the anti-God? If you have any lingering doubts, let the words of Sir Julian Huxley clear them up. Huxley, extreme evolutionist and atheist, stated, quote, "Any view of God as a personal being is becoming frankly untenable. Creation, creation of earth and stars, plants, animals, and men, Darwin swept the last vestiges of that into the waste paper basket. Unquote. Do you wonder how Christians can embrace this thing and even teach it? Darwinism did its job of sweeping God and creation into the waste paper basket, and now, ironically, Darwinism itself has been dumped into the waste paper basket. However, we must give full marks to Darwinism's success. It has emptied God out of the minds of whole nations that were Christian nations. And the new evolution will keep things that way, unless we can get the information spread that Darwinism is dead and its replacement, evolution by punctuated equilibria, is absolute nonsense, unscientific nonsense, which shows the bankruptcy and the desperation of the evolution camp. Writer Norman Macbeth lambasted the new punctuated equilibria in these blunt words, quote, "It is not a scientific theory. It is only a statement that evolutionism is in such terrible shape that it must have been something in the order of a miracle. It's a counsel of despair, a wild hope," unquote. That's Macbeth on punctuated equilibria. If the public gets to know of the shambles of the evolution camp, the theory of any sort of evolution will soon be deader than dead. But how can the public get to know? Evolution still rides high in the mass media and the schools, while the facts against evolution are barred. And this is censorship. There must be a reason. The reason is the battle for young minds. The battle for young minds is going to be the decisive battle, and in this we must look to America. The real battle will be won or lost in America, in the state legislatures and the law courts of the United States of America. The creationists had a temporary success in Arkansas, where a law was passed requiring schools in Arkansas which taught evolution to give equal time to creation. Thereupon, anti-Christian forces challenged the law as unconstitutional. After court proceedings, the law was overturned, and we lost in Arkansas. We lost the Arkansas case, and the Arkansas schools can carry on with evolution and the indoctrination of evolution and ignore creation. Well, the creationists then took the fight to Louisiana. Louisiana enacted a law requiring schools that teach evolution to give equal time to creation. Again, anti-Christians have challenged the law, and creationists have had another setback, which we hope is only temporary. The Louisiana court ruled that the legislature has no power to direct what shall be taught in schools. But not all is lost. Far from it. The creationists have lodged an appeal in the Federal Appeals Court, and they're fairly confident that the appeals court will pass the matter back to the Louisiana Supreme Court. And in that court, there's a good chance that the creationists will win. If that happens, the Balanced Treatment Act will go into force in Louisiana. And then, I'm told, there are many other states ready to go with their own legislation requiring equal time for creation. It's fair to say that the future of American education hinges on the Louisiana outcome. To the evolutionists, money is no object in opposing creation. I'm informed that they spent about $2 million in fighting the Arkansas law in the law courts. I'm also informed that they have already spent another $1 million in Louisiana and will spend something like a further $1 million in the courts in their efforts to quash that Louisiana law. Such fantastic spending shows that the evolutionists see clearly the crucial importance of whether evolution shall prevail in young minds. Also, it shows where the money power lies. They spend millions, while the poor creationists are appealing for donations to enable them to carry on the case. At this point, the question needs to be asked, what does the American public think? Do Americans want creation in their schools? Statistics show that 76% of Americans want creation to be given equal time in schools. 76%. Another 10% want creation only. Only creation in schools and no evolution. So that makes a total of 86% of Americans wanting creation taught in schools. It means that the wishes of the vast majority of Americans are being thwarted. Thwarted by a tiny minority of rabid evolutionists backed by money power. And some of you know the role of big money and won't be surprised at that. Creationists in America are fighting an extraordinary fight. I hope Australians will soon come to realize the awful seriousness of the evolution monopoly, will realize that the evolution issue is the most serious issue of all, because evolution is the seedbed of all the errors and heresies and immoralities that are plaguing this cursed century. And evolution is the source of all attacks on the Christian faith. The battle is for young minds, and the outlook is dark. Yet even in this dark outlook, America provides some light. The evolution establishment is worried because, in the United States, the percentage of science graduates who accept evolution has fallen below 50%. And that is the fruit of the counterattack by creation scientists. Against all the odds, with the mass media and the education system ranged against them, and the money power against them, against all odds, creation scientists are getting balanced information across to the people, and the American public are responding. Through the efforts of many dedicated scientists, there is now a vast literature demolishing evolution. So I decided to try to write a book. My modest aim was to provide, in simple language, a concise digest of that vast literature. On the evolution scene, events had moved so fast that I'm pleased that I didn't start writing The Crumbling Theory of Evolution until 1981 was well advanced. If I had written it sooner, I'd have missed revolutionary developments such as the Chicago Convention, and also some new information challenging cosmic evolution. Until late 1981, I just could not have navigated the confused waters of man's supposed evolution from beasts, because finds and counterfinds were going on with conflicting theories between the superstars, Donald Johanson and his team on one side, and Richard and Mary Leakey on the other side. I reckon late 1981 was about the right time to deal with that tricky subject of man's supposed evolution from ape men. Furthermore, while I was writing the book, there happened the bombshell of September 1981, when two world leaders of evolution, ex-agnostic Sir Fred Hoyle and ex-atheist Chandrawick Ramasinghe, jointly announced that their separate mathematics demonstrated that life could not have spontaneously generated on Earth, but that life must have been intelligently created. Quote, "An enormous intelligence must be abroad in the universe," unquote. This courageous admission by two eminent evolutionists is a severe blow to the key point of the general theory of evolution, namely, evolution of life. But these two men didn't go as far as to accept the Christian God. What they seem to be accepting is God is the universe, and they seem to believe now in evolution by a series of leaps, and that this was begun by spores of life, intelligently created in space, which somehow arrived on Earth. Well, whatever their new philosophy, these top evolutionists have confirmed that science and mathematics show that lifeless matter could not become alive without the intervention of an intelligent creator. And that hits the general theory of evolution where it hurts most. Well, it's one thing for creation scientists to attack the theory, but it's something else when the theory is openly jolted by evolutionists and by leading evolutionists of the stature of Sir Fred Hoyle and Chandrawick Ramasinghe, and by such a top evolutionist as Dr. Francis Crick, Nobel Prize winner and co-discoverer of DNA. He recently announced that life could not have begun on Earth from lifeless matter. But he, too, didn't turn to the Christian God. Instead, he proposed an odd theory that some advanced civilization in outer space must have sent germs of life to Earth by rocket ship. Again, we see the pattern. The secular man seems unable to leap the chasm to the Christian God. Even when his anti-God theory of evolution comes unstuck, he'll patch it and prop it with something, however outlandish, rather than discard it. And the theory is becoming unstuck. All its basic tenets, everything on which the theory has been based, have fallen apart and are under criticism from within the evolutionist ranks. And that's the big point. Evolutionists themselves are criticizing the basics of evolution. Take Dr. Colin Paterson of the British Museum of Natural History. In 1981, Dr. Paterson publicly stated that he awoke one morning and realized that there is not one thing about evolution that he knows for sure. He put the question to other scientists and met a blank every time. Not one of those scientists could tell him any one thing about evolution known to be true. Paterson then publicly stated that the hypothesis of common ancestry of living creatures is actually anti-knowledge, meaning it goes against their present knowledge. After all that, he hasn't abandoned evolution. But what an admission! A book just published, 1982, The Neck of the Giraffe, or Where Darwin Went Wrong, is by Francis Hitching, a member of the Royal Archaeological Institute, and it's a detailed refutation of everything that hitherto constituted the case for evolution. Again, he hasn't suddenly become a creationist. That requires something more than cold logic. In fact, he dismisses creation science, and he leans towards the new fancy, evolution by big jumps. But page after page of his book demolishes evolution as it was. And as far as I can see, all that is put in its place are scientific blanks, filled with faith and hope and invincible speculation. Just as a sample, and I think I've got him right, how did the giraffe get its long neck? Well, he has four options. Number one, Lamarck's old theory that short-necked deer, or something, would stretch their necks to feed on high trees, and gradually their necks lengthened. Well, he can't go along with that one. That one is out. Number two, Darwinism. Natural selection selected those who were best able to feed from the trees. Well, he can't have that, because Darwinism and natural selection are out. Number three, creation. Giraffes were created as giraffes. Well, that won't do at all. Creation is taboo. So he has to accept number four, the new idea, which is that some unknown laws somehow determine what a species will evolve into. So the explanation, more or less acceptable, is that the ancestors, whatever it was that was ancestral, the ancestors of giraffes had an inbuilt tendency to long necks, and that made it possible for the sudden jumps from short necks to long necks, which would leave no fossil evidence of the evolution of the giraffe. Well now, if you call that science, you just cannot knock TV's Incredible Hulk as science. When evolutionists themselves are rushing forward to debunk the very dogmas on which the theory was founded and flourished, and are substituting new doctrines of unscientific bizarrity, why does the general public still believe in evolution? In the Christendom of old, the common creed, the universal belief, was belief in Christ. But not so in today's Christendom. In this Christendom, if there's one common universal belief, it's not in Christ. It's belief in evolution of some sort. Today, when the theory of evolution is in shambles, when even its high priests are disillusioned, evolution still grips the general mind. One reason is that because of indoctrination, some minds cannot accept supernatural creation. A greater reason is that the channels of information are controlled, and they are propagating evolution as a tool for destroying God and the supernatural. If balanced truth were given, evolution would not survive. If creationists had a fraction of the big money and had control of the media for just 1 week, evolution would disappear from the face of the earth. Demolishing biological evolution is important, but equally important is demolishing those billion-year ages by showing that the evidence really supports a young earth and a young universe, not billions of years, but only some thousands of years old. In my book, I deal with this at some length. However, I missed one little thing, one thing that pretty well wraps up the case, because I got hold of it after publication. I hope it will be included in a future printing. This is that little thing. A few hundred years ago, Bishop Usher, using biblical chronology, estimated that creation took place in the year 4004 BC, and that was accepted until Darwin and the new geology took over and brought new estimates of time that grew from a few millions to many millions of years to billions of years. Then the Usher chronology became a standard joke, the butt of the scorn of our enlightened age. Creation in 4004 BC? What a laugh. Bishop Usher and his Bible believers have long been figures of fun for our scientific age. But now, the laughing should stop. Dr. John Eddy, solar physicist, has been making detailed observations of the sun, observations which, under some interpretations, are throwing into doubt basic theories of the age of the sun. Dr. Eddy, as an evolutionist, says he suspects that the sun is 4.5 billion years old. However, he also says this, I quote, "I suspect we could live with Bishop Usher's value for the age of the earth and sun. I don't think, listen to this, I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence to conflict with that," unquote. Put another way, he's saying that the theories of billions of years of cosmic evolution have not much scientific data to support them. This leader in the field of solar physics is as good as saying that the book of Genesis is unshaken by the facts of science. If only that could be told to our students. The theory of evolution will be kept going in some form or other because it is basic to a long-range plan. The plan? God and the supernatural must be nullified in the people's minds. Christianity must be destroyed. And in the modern world, the foremost destroyers of Christianity are humanism and Marxism, and, I might add, modernism within the churches. And these three have been fairly successful. They have supplanted the Creator God with the force of evolution. All three rely on evolution. Without evolution, they would simply collapse. First, in the churches, modernism. It's been called the synthesis of all heresies. Modernism interprets all doctrines in accordance with evolution science. Next, Marxism. Karl Marx began the Communist Manifesto with the evolutionary concept. Also, Marx equated humanism with Marxism. Marx said, quote, "Humanism is the denial of God and the total affirmation of man." Marx said, "Humanism is really nothing else but Marxism." And that is straight from Marx. So, what about humanism? One of the leaders of humanism, Sir Julian Huxley, pointed out that humanism's keynote, the central concept to which all humanism's details are related, is, guess what, is evolution. And now, as evolution-based Marxist humanism marches forward, let's not be surprised to see the rise of abortion and sex education to ruin further the remains of our culture. They have not happened by chance. They could not happen unless the way had been prepared for them by Marxist humanism. On abortion, I agree with Dr. Hemingway of Warrnambool, who said, "The evolution theory, at least in its extreme or atheistic form, must bear a share of the blame for the thousands upon thousands of abortions performed every day." Unquote. Evolution has dismissed God and His commandments. Thus the modern world, in a moral vacuum, not only aborts babies, but also makes us all help pay the medical bills. Then there's sex education in schools. The new sex education is devilish. A Randy Engel has written a critique of the United States Catholic Conference Sex Education Guidelines. It's a bit of a mouthful, but that is the title. He shows that sex education comes direct from the humanists. He calls the new sex education a steel-spiked fist wrapped in a velvet glove and directed towards the total destruction of Christianity, especially the Christian family. He says, "The new sex education seeks to destroy Christian teachings on sexual morality and replace them with an entire new set of morals and values." Another book, The Seeker's Circle, S-I-E-C-U-S Circle, by Claire Chambers, makes the point that communists and humanists work together to promote the godless humanist concepts, to promote atheism, evolution, and situation ethics. And the book makes this further point, namely, "Since the Seeker's pattern of comprehensive sex education conforms to the humanistic concepts, it can be seen why the late Congressman James Utt, UTT, warned that one of the basic activities of the communists is the promotion of complete sex education in almost all school grades." Now, I have tried to put many thoughts before you tonight. Perhaps the most important point I want to make is this. Whatever moral evil you're fighting against, you have to start with the theory of evolution. If your fight is against communism or humanism, if your fight is against abortion or sex education in schools, if you're fighting godless assaults on your children's faith, or education tainted with humanism, or the promotion of homosexuality, or hard rock music with its dope and sex and occultism, if your fight is against modernism in the churches, whatever you're fighting against, you simply must fight evolution first. Unless you can get evolution out, you are fighting a rearguard action, because evolution is the destroyer of true Christianity, and only true Christianity can defeat all the other evils, evils born of the general theory of evolution and sustained by it. Get evolution out, and then the compromises and the doubts go out too. And right Christian thinking falls into place, and that is the only starting point, no matter what your personal fight is against. Whatever you do, do something to get the facts against evolution spread around. That is the key to all the rest. I began my book with a quote from Newman Watts. "Every attack on the Christian faith has as its basis the doctrine of evolution." I use the same quote to end the main part of the book. Now, let me conclude this talk with the concluding words of my book. "Today, when the theory of evolution can be shown to be not credible, we behold the paradox of a new surge of evolutionary propaganda flooding the world through the mass media and the education system. It must be terribly important to some people to persuade men that they are only animals and that science needs no God. If you're wondering why, the following will help to explain. Newman Watts, a London journalist, wrote a book entitled Britain Without God. In his research for that book, he discovered something. He discovered that those who would shoot Christianity to pieces are using the bullets of evolution. This is his warning, decisive and clear. Every attack on the Christian faith made today has as its basis the doctrine of evolution. I thank you.